Minnesota. Welcome in to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. It's a Thursday afternoon. Busy show ahead of us today, as coming up in the second half, we're going to be speaking with JT Hines of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, as we're going to be getting more details about this Supreme Court case that is coming up, at least the state Supreme Court, in regards to PolyMet's permits. We'll also chat with him a little bit, too, about Keith Ellison's lawsuit against the big oil lobby. But first, happy to welcome back one of our frequent guests on the show, Professor David Schultz. He is a political science professor over at Hamline University, also has a blog, schultzestake.blogspot.com, a great political analyst, and he joins us now. Hey, David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me on, and thanks to the audience for listening.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start off with what happened in the state legislature last week, where we had a special session that was convened, and for the most part, well, not a whole lot really got accomplished. And as you wrote about in your blog, you were talking about how the big question to ask is not necessarily why nothing got passed, but more the dynamic of why essentially nothing really got through the state legislature. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure, and I guess right after the Senate, Republican Senate, adjourned, people started saying, boy, nothing got accomplished. It was a train wreck, that there was kind of the shock and surprise. And I wasn't shocked and surprised at all regarding what happened, because there were a lot of things that were leading into the session that lead into the special session that suggested it was going to fail. And to start off with, let's take us back to really almost the beginning of the legislative session this year. When you and I first talked, probably back in February, about the session, we noted that there was pretty significant political division. Obviously, of course, there's the Republican Senate versus the democratically controlled House. We could, of course, have looked at that point and said, look at how they're not just partisanly divided, but they're divided on really critical issues. Issues at that point, remember, it would have been over the size of the bonding bill, maybe over what was thought to be a surplus, over funding for early childhood education. And then, of course, we progressed through the session. The first shock to the system became the coronavirus, and we had a partisan divide over the coronavirus regarding should the governor be allowed emergency authorities to be able to tighten up, our, let's use phrase, to just basically shut down part of the economy. So the Republicans were disagreeable on that. They were disagreeable on the bonding bill, a whole bunch of things. The point being is that on May 18th, when the legislative session, regular session ended, there were divisions over the size of the bonding bill, over handling of the coronavirus, a whole bunch of things, right? So we had this huge division. Several weeks passed. The killing of George Floyd occurred, of which then there was yet another issue over which the legislature divided. And the reason why I mention all of this and sort of put it together here is that going into the special session, we had significant pre-existing partisan and policy divides between the Democrats and the Republicans, and there was very little work that had been done during the interim between regular session and the special session to try to narrow that gap. And so we went into the special session pretty much exactly where we ended the regular session, divided, no consensus, and then add to that George Floyd, and the division just got even larger.
It was interesting, too, to watch the end of the regular session, how it seemed like a lot of the legislatures were saying, well, we can just deal with all of these things we didn't do during the special session. And people might be surprised to think, well, why did nothing get accomplished during the special session that we just had? But you pointed out the dynamic as to why that didn't happen, and there was no agreement in the interim, which is really unusual for a special session, because most times when a governor calls for that, there's usually some sort of plan put together as to what's going to be passed. But this obviously wasn't the case, and for the most part, this was really only called to extend the emergency powers of Governor Tim Walz.
Right, and that's part of the other point that I make here is that initially there were perhaps that was the main reason for calling the special session again. Recall that, just so listeners know, that if the governor invokes his peacetime or peacetime domestic emergency authority, he can do that for 30 days, then has to give the legislature an opportunity to be able to vote it down if they disagree. And so given the timing, after he had previously extended his authority on May 12th, he had to bring this legislature back in session by June 12th to be able to vote on it again. So that's the first reason for a special session to do that. The second reason then becomes the governor says we have unfinished business, bonding bill, a whole bunch of other things. And then the killing of George Floyd then created a third reason. And you might recall it was the June 10th, 2 days before the session started, where the governor said, we have to do police reform. It's really important to do this. And it is. There's no question about it. So we went into special session with three biggies that had to be done, where there was not groundwork laid to be able to resolve any of them. And in many ways, this is what made it complicated. It's almost like a jigsaw puzzle now. All three of them were interrelated. And what I mean by that, the Republicans were saying, we're not willing to move on a bonding bill unless we get concessions from the governor on his authority regarding peacetime emergencies and opening up the economy. At the same time, then, this all got caught up with the reaction to George Floyd's killing and the police reforms, because Republicans also did not perceive this to be a major issue for them, something that I think they wanted to also get some concessions from the Democrats on. So we've got it's almost like you can't solve one without solving the other. And since there was no consensus on how to solve any of them, I think what wound up happening, especially with the Republicans going into the special session, they said, well, we're only going to be around for a week anyhow. And so when the week came, they walked away. Now, the other thing to think about here is the fact that the governor is likely, especially with all the data that we're starting to see now about the coronavirus still being a problem, is going to probably want to extend his peacetime authority again, which means he's going to probably have to bring them back into another special session in July. And unless we see some negotiations going on, I think that session is going to end just like the one that we just saw.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on that. And, of course, we have the other aspect to add that we are heading into an election year where control of what's now dominated by Republicans, well, maybe not dominated, they do have a small majority. Sure. Of course, that is very much up in the air as to who's going to control that once we hit 2021. So I want to ask you about this. Is there any political upside for either party, and maybe focusing more on the Republican side, to not get anything done? Because as I was chatting with some Capitol reporters, it kind of felt like the Republicans' best play might just be to say, well, this is a problem of the leadership of the city of Minneapolis and not so much on a state level, and maybe it's to their political gain not to even have anything passed unless they get significant concessions from the DFL House and Governor Walz.
I think that's exactly correct. You know, I think I said in my blog that the further you get away from Minneapolis geographically, the less salient the issues are and less important they are to many of the Republican legislators. For somebody up in Thief River Falls, maybe down in, I don't know, just pick some other corner of the state or something like that, they view this as what? As you said here, a problem for Minneapolis, a problem for the Twin Cities. It's not an issue that they consider to be important. On top of which, think about how the Democrats and Governor Walz are describing some issues. Governor Walz is saying that we really need a bonding bill so that we can help rebuild the state economy at a time we are right now. We really need police reform to address these problems. I think many of the Republicans
would love nothing more than to frustrate the Democrats and saying that this is what you really want. We're not going to give you that stuff. Then they can run against the Democrats in terms of saying, look at that. They couldn't deliver on critical issues. But also, I think at this point, given that some of these issues, such again, as police reform, are just not important or as important to them as they are to Democrats, I think they can walk away from these and just say, well, you know, these are not important to our constituents. We'll basically let the elections decide what the important issues are. So I think that is part of the dynamic that's occurring here. And the closer we get to the November elections, the more powerful will be the sense that politicking, partisan positioning, will dominate or outweigh any interest in actually getting substantive policy passed.
I think to even expand on this, this was just announced today by Republican Senate Majority Paul Gazelka that during the next session, he wants to hold hearings on the looting and fires that, of course, occurred a few weeks ago, and also have a review of the Christopher Columbus statue, which was torn down. Then that, of course, plays right into their hands of what they want to have the focus on, not so much on police reform, but focusing on looting and fires and tearing down statues.
No, I think you're right. I think this is a battle of framing right now, that the Democrats, I think, correctly want to frame the issue as to say that we've got a significant problem with let's say police use of excessive force, and we need to be doing something to address these issues. The Republicans, I think, are going to frame the issue, and they're getting the cues from Donald Trump, who's doing this exactly, is to say, well, what is the lesson from all of this? The lesson is about what? Law and order, looting, burning, demonstrations, destroying of property. What is it, in the last day or so, Donald Trump issued an executive order saying that he's going to, you know, make sure that nobody destroys federal property, even though it's already illegal, of course, to do that. He's thinking about what, assigning guards to, like, statues across. Yeah, so this is about reframing the issue so that it's not about legitimate concerns about race and police power in our state, but again, frames it in a way that makes it sound like what, that it is about people out of control, breaking the law, et cetera, et cetera.
Speaking with David Schultz Hamlin, University Professor of Political Science and also an expert on the legal system and the court of law, and a couple questions regarding that. Of course, yesterday we had Attorney General Keith Ellison announcing that he is going to be filing a lawsuit against several companies that are part of, well, for the lack of a better way of putting it, the big oil industry. And as I was talking about this yesterday, there are a lot of parallels between this and what we saw with the tobacco lawsuit of the 1990s. And one of the things my guest brought up yesterday was that, well, one of the reasons why Skip Humphrey, who was the attorney general in the 90s, succeeded was that in his argument, he was able to bring up that, well, tobacco was affecting children. And he was thinking, well, maybe that would be a tougher argument to make in terms of climate change. But what are your thoughts on this lawsuit and Ellison's potential strategy for trying to win for the state of Minnesota?
Well, I think there's a couple. I think since the tobacco case, something else important has happened, by the way. There was a famous U.S. Supreme Court case around 2007, 2006. I'm forgetting the exact date. It was called Massachusetts versus the Environmental Protection Agency. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that states have legal standing, that is, the ability to sue under the Clean Air Act to try to force the federal government to address, global, greenhouse gas emissions. And the reason why I mention that is that in that case, in order to be able to bring it, Massachusetts said that, listen, if we continue to face global warming, we as a state of Massachusetts are going to face significant damage to our shorelines, as the seas rise, et cetera, et cetera. So we're being injured. Therefore, we're allowed to bring a case. And the reason why that's important is that that has made it easier, that decision, for states to be able to bring cases in ways that it was harder to do when the tobacco litigation occurred in Minnesota back in 1998, if I remember correctly. So that I think now Keith Ellison has, I don't want to say an easy argument to make, but an easier argument to make than in 98 to say that, listen, if we don't address some of the pollution problems, some of the global warming issues, it's going to not only presently injure the state of Minnesota, but down the line, including to our children or grandchildren and so forth, it'll have damages on, it'll damage them, it'll damage their environment, et cetera, et cetera. So I think he's got a little bit, again, of an easier aspect on being able to bring the case than we had, than the state had, that Skip Humphrey had, you know, a generation ago. Now, again, still no guarantee that Keith Ellison wins, but it's certainly with that Massachusetts versus EPA decision, it adds, let's say, cogency or precedent to being able to sue or bring this type of lawsuit in the way that was, again, harder a long time ago.
And if this lawsuit were to end up going in favor of Ellison and the state of Minnesota, I imagine this would have a pretty massive impact on a lot of these oil companies, since potentially that could encourage other states to enact similar, well, lawsuits.
Well, I would hope so. Now, what I hope we've learned, though, from the tobacco litigation, what grew out of the tobacco litigation was that the tobacco industry basically made a massive multi-year payout to many states, including Minnesota, of which supposedly was going to help Minnesota in terms of smoking cessation programs, getting people to quit. And what's unfortunately has happened is that Minnesota, as well as many other states, didn't take their damage awards and do as much as they could there. Additionally, we gave, as part of that tobacco settlement, a lot of immunity to the tobacco industry from future lawsuits. What I would hope that the Attorney General does, and whatever type, assuming Ellison wins, is A, we don't basically say, just give us a bunch of money and that's it and walk away, and B, we don't let the tobacco industry, or rather, we don't let the oil industry off the hook in the same way that I think we unfortunately as a nation did with the tobacco industry. So again, hoping the hindsight of what worked and what didn't work back then, we can better formulate a remedy for addressing these problems, and that if we were to win, not only is it a model for the rest of the country, but whatever the settlement is, that we actually use those resources for addressing global warming problems. But more importantly, what I would hope is that what we ask the oil industry to do is what? Change your behavior.
Yeah.
I think that's what most of us really want at this point, is change your behavior.
Final question for you, David, and might be putting you on the spot with this one, but this, I just Sock came across the newswire, and this really interests me in terms of its constitutionality. It looks like the state of New York is going to be trying to impose travel restrictions on residents from the state of Texas. What is the constitutionality in terms of trying to ban state-by-state travel?
This is a really good question. I wrote about this a couple of months ago and said that, first off, I'll point out that the Supreme Court has ruled that we have a right to interstate travel, that under normal circumstances, Wisconsin can't say to Minnesotans, you can't enter our state. We have a right to freely move across our borders, which is one of our cherished First Amendment rights. Now, when it gets to this issue of addressing a serious public health matter, this becomes a little bit of an open constitutional question. Probably another state can't prevent somebody from another state from entering. Could they impose, let's say, a quarantine? Because I think what New York is thinking, what, a 14-day quarantine? Connecticut and New Jersey are joining in on that. This is a really interesting constitutional question here, of which we don't really have an open answer. Now, if I actually knew that Schultz was sick, let's say I'm the state of New York, Schultz wants to enter, is infectious, probably there's no problem in the world under the law of saying we're going to force Schultz to go into quarantine. But what if Schultz is not symptomatic? We don't know if he has the coronavirus. I think it becomes much more complicated. Now, I'll take it one step further. Could the state of New York require anybody getting off of an airplane or coming into the state to take a coronavirus test, COVID-19 test, to see if they were see if they have disease or not? Again, we don't have clear law on this, and I think we're going to see some really interesting case law on this. My guess is that that states are going to have to incredibly narrowly tailor their policies because they can't just do a blanket prohibition.
Interesting. Yeah. If we next time we get a little more time, I want to chat about that more because that's a really, really interesting topic. But unfortunately, we are up against the clock right now. And Professor David Schultz, really appreciate your time today. Again, he is a Hanlon University professor of political science, also has a blog, schultzstake.blogspot.com. David, thanks again for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks to the audience.
Absolutely. We'll take a break. Come on back with more on FYI Politics.
Here at Osprey Wilds on beautiful Cryonstone Lake near Sandstone, we hope you and your family are staying safe. Although our office is closed, our trails remain open to the public. Watch the sunset, listen to the birds, look for flowers, and enjoy a few moments of peace. For more information, visit OspreyWilds.org. That's OspreyWilds.org.
I'm Candy Broffel, publisher of the Twin Cities edition of Natural Awakenings magazine and host of Green Tea Conversations, a new show for people who are on a journey to take responsibility for their health and play a more active role in their family's well-being. Join me every Sunday at 10 a.m. as I interview local experts who share the latest in natural holistic approaches in a fun and informative way. So grab a cup of tea and join the conversation as we awaken to natural health. Visit us at naturaltwincities.com.
All Energy Solar is still committed to saving you on your next energy system through their zero-contact protocol. They can evaluate your property without visiting your home through calls and webinars. But incentive programs are expiring soon, so start saving on your energy bill today and visit allenergysolar.com.
Minuteman Press Uptown is still open. It's printing everything. But they are taking some extra precautions. You can order by phone or online and do curbside pickup. Plus, they can help restaurants staying open with direct mail and geofencing. That's Minuteman Press Uptown.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our new show airing on Saturdays from noon to 1, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights to living and aging well. Each week, we provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and caregiver support to help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to 1 for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
Standard Heating and Air Conditioning knows it's June when us Minnesotans finally stop talking about how cold it is and start talking about how hot it is, which is the perfect time for Standard's Summer Is Here sale. During June, you can save $900 on a new air conditioner with payments as low as $47 a month for 0% financing. Find out more about these great savings at standardheating.com. Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, the comfort you deserve since 1930.
Listen to Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake every Saturday, 1 to 3 p.m. Each Saturday, we have guests speaking their truth from all over Turtle Island. Support comes from Mitchell Hamlin School of Law on beautiful Summit Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota. At Mitchell Hamlin, law students can stay in their communities and specialize in Indian law. They can complete their JD full-time, part-time, in-person, and online. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu.
If you're looking to save money on your home or building improvement project, check out Better Futures Minnesota's Reuse Retail Warehouse in South Minneapolis. We carry salvaged building materials such as cabinetry, flooring, plumbing fixtures, appliances, lighting, and more, saving you money and saving the planet by keeping these items out of the landfill, by giving them another life. Selections change daily, and we also take donations. Go to betterfuturesminnesota.com and look under Reuse Warehouse to learn more. Let us know AM 950 sent you.
If you have a painting project, you should consider hiring Nick Slavic Painting and Restoration Company. We've been awarded nationally for craftsmanship, are highly professional, responsive, and fairly priced. If you feel overwhelmed by starting a painting project, we make it easy from start to finish. We move furniture, vacuum, sweep, dust, and put your home back the way we found it. There is a difference. Our professionalism sets us apart. Visit NICKSLAVIK.com. That's NickSlavic.com to learn more.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Going to switch gears now and talk a little bit more about environmental news, as we do have several developments that have come through over the past few days or so in regards to PolyMet, also Attorney General Keith Ellison's lawsuit against the oil lobby, and then just something that came across today, being that the Fond du Lac Band of the Ojibwe, the Fond du Lac Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa are going to be getting some news in regards to a water tower they were trying to get built. So lots to talk about, and joining us on the show from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, he's their Northern Minnesota advocate, is J.T. Haynes, who joins us now on the show. Hey there, J.T., how are you doing today?
Hi, Brett. Good. How are you?
Hey, doing good here. So I want to talk about this Supreme Court case that's going to be coming up in regards to PolyMet, because, it was back a few months ago. The Court of Appeals basically struck down PolyMet's air pollution or air permit that was originally issued and approved. It was struck down. And can you talk a little bit about the background of that case and how the appeals court came to their ruling?
Yeah, sure. I actually think it's important to start by noting that PolyMet does not currently have the permits they need to build or construct a mine. The courts have actually struck down several permits.
Mm-hmm.
The news we're talking about here is the air permit. They've also struck down the permit to mine and the dam construction permit. And, of course, the water pollution permit is suspended pending multiple investigations.
Mm-hmm.
So because of this news, PolyMet's actually told the agencies that they don't have an intent to begin construction in 2020. So that's the general background of the PolyMet cases. In terms of the air permit case, it's about air pollution. That's what that permit is meant to regulate. But what's interesting about this case is this is the one that is actually about the size of the mine. So what happened here in essence is that PolyMet has communicated two completely different mine plans, one to Minnesota and our agencies, and a much larger plan to its investors. So all
a little bit of a difference there, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of a difference. So it's a 32,000 ton per day mine plan that they've applied for, permits for. But to the investors, they communicated a 118,000 ton per day mine plan, which for those doing math, that's 3.6 times the size,
mm-hmm.
but at the same speed. So actually a year shorter. So essentially they'd be mining 3.6 times more ore in the same amount of time. So all the reasons that the PolyMet proposal are problematic to begin with are even more problematic with the mega PolyMet proposal.
And I think what was significant about this Court of Appeals ruling a few months back, and I think you were alluding to this, is that this essentially invalidated every PolyMet permit, correct?
Well, this would certainly prevent PolyMet needs an air pollution permit to construct,
yeah.
So this certainly affects all the permits.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's useful to note also that not only would there be more air pollution if this permit were to go through, but that would also mean more tailings, more water pollution, you know, a riskier dam. History has suggested that, like, when we cut corners in terms of risk management by putting more tailings behind the dam, it's actually riskier, too. So, yeah, in that sense, this permit actually absolutely does go to all the permits that are sort of at play here.
Yeah, so fortunately, the project, as you said, is pretty much at a halt right now. I want to go back to this idea, though, because as you were saying, well, they were giving different information to regulators as to what they were saying with the investors. At least on the side of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the MPCA, was it just the case that they weren't really doing their due diligence and trying to figure out that, well, they're actually trying to build a mine that's four times bigger than they actually say? Because that's quite a variance to have them be telling such a difference in terms of their plans of what they want to build.
Well, PolyMet's argument has been if they don't present that application to the agency, then the agency doesn't need to review it. And, of course, MCEA, we've presented evidence about this alternative, much larger plan to the MPCA, and we presented that evidence on multiple occasions before the permit was issued. And what we've said is, you know, if there is evidence that they have an intention to build something larger than what the permit application is for, that's evidence of a sham permit. That's mm-hmm. called sham permitting. When you apply for, in this case, a minor synthetic permit, where if you were actually pursuing the larger mine plan, it would require a major permit. When you apply for the smaller permit but mean a larger plan, that's actually called sham permitting. And the Court of Appeals agreed with us and said, yeah, if there's evidence of sham permitting, you know, clearly the MPCA should have reviewed that evidence, and they did not do that here.
The other thing I've been kind of following along with this case is that, as far as I can tell, on all of these permits that PolyMet has applied for, it sounds like their parent company, Glencore, is not actually listed on any of these permits. Is that still the case? Because Glencore obviously is a huge, huge multinational company that has a pretty atrocious record when it comes to labor rights and the environment. And, yeah, that's a big problem if their name's not even included on the permit, being that, well, they're the ones that should be responsible should anything happen if that mine were to be built.
Right. And a lot has happened on this case, even since the permits were issued. We've got PolyMet still communicating this larger mine plan to its investors. I mean, the larger mine plan is still on PolyMet's website, even as this case is proceeding. Meanwhile, this mega international corporation, Glencore, has officially acquired 72% of the PolyMet Corporation. Of course, Glencore has exerted significant control over PolyMet for a long time, and we've been trying to raise alarm bells about that for quite a long time because of their really terrible environmental record worldwide and their terrible labor record around the globe. But now they officially own the company, and this is one of the areas that actually Governor Walz has spoken to directly. He inherited a mess from the former administration, and you know he's making his own decisions, and his commissioners are making their own decisions about how to deal with that mess. But one thing he has said is, yeah, I mean, if Glencore controls this, they ought to be on the hook for these permits. And you are correct in saying that they are not currently on those permits. By the way, though, this is one of the things that the court has said that needs to be reviewed. So for the dam permit and the permit to mine, the court has ordered a contested case hearing. And one of the issues is about Glencore's role on the permits. So that case is also being reviewed at the Supreme Court. If it goes forward per the court's order, we will be having evidentiary hearings about whether Glencore should be on the permit.
What impact would that have if their name is required to be on these permits? Would that make them a little bit more hesitant to build this mine, being that, well, Glencore doesn't want to financially be on the hook? Or I'm kind of asking you to look into the crystal ball on this, but what would happen if that ruling were to go that way, where they would have to put Glencore's name on there?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. If Glencore's on the permit, that means more risk and more liability for Glencore. Now, obviously, what they want is maximum return and minimum risk. So they want to have an asset in Minnesota where they can extract profit and leave all the risk and all the pollution with Minnesotans. And having them on the permit, which of course is appropriate, would increase the sharing of that risk. By the way, that may not suffice in making it a good deal for Minnesota, but it would make it more fair. It would make it more fair and a more proper balancing of risk if Glencore were on part of the financial hook.
Yeah, the environmental damage would still be the same, just we might get compensated from it instead of just having them say, oopsie, oh, I guess the state of Minnesota, you got to pay for all these damages. Yeah, the environmental damage is still going to occur, potentially, if it's built, no matter whose name is on that permit.
That's right. The environmental damage, when it's done, it's done. And it's not even a potential. I mean, PolyMet's own proposal shows significant environmental damage. Even if the 36,000-ton-per-day plant goes forward, we're talking hundreds of acres of direct wetland destruction, thousands of acres of indirect wetland damage, millions and billions of gallons of water processed and polluted, and hundreds of millions of gallons of water stored permanently polluted. So that is absolutely correct. The environmental portion of this will be on the hook for Minnesotans permanently, no matter what happens with Glencore and the permits, if the mine's built.
Yeah, if it's been, I'm kind of with you on that. Hopefully it doesn't get built, but yeah, as long as it's tied up in all these legal proceedings, hopefully that'll make them kind of think twice about this and eventually not building the mine altogether. All right, JT, I want to talk about a couple other topics with you, and this one was something that just came down today, and I have to apologize, I'm not really up to speed on this case, but this has to do with the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Commissioner, Mark Phillips, approving a $250,000 grant to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, where these funds are basically going to be put towards a new water tower that would serve communities in Monoman and Brookston. Can you fill us in a little bit about this case? Because it sounds like there was some controversy in regards to how this was proceeding. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so on June 10th at the regular meeting of the IRRRB, there were 10 grants submitted to the board for approval. One of the 10 grants was from the Fond du Lac Band, and it was for a water treatment facility for the Monoman community. Now, importantly, the Monoman community is within the IRRRB Taconite Assistance Area service area. So staff at that meeting made it very clear that not only does this project qualify for IRRRB funding, it actually also scored very highly. And staff also noted clearly for the board that the water currently in Monoman is undrinkable. So the staff basically said this project should be funded, in so many words.
Mm-hmm.
And the IRRB, the board, tabled the request. It was the only one of the 10 grants that wasn't acted on that day. And this was under the initial suggestion and leadership of Senator Tom Bach. And he stated fairly explicitly that the reason he said he was, quote, uncomfortable approving this grant at the time was that the Fond du Lac Band has been involved in, he called it, anti-mining activities. The band issued a statement saying, we're not anti-mining, we're anti-pollution. And I think the Fond du Lac Band and a lot of the community has roundly responded to Senator Bach saying, you know, the band has both an obligation and an absolute right to defend treaty resources. You know, and if they're involved in state processes around preventing pollution and protecting water, you know, that is their right, and that is not what the IRRRB should be doing and considering when they're looking at these grants.
That, I'm just trying to connect the dots right there. Even if they were so-called anti-mining, what would that have to do with the fact that, well, they need a new water tower in that area? I'm just not quite following the logic that Senator Bach is even using behind what he's saying.
It's backwards logic, and he got it absolutely wrong here, Senator Bach did. But what his stated logic is if you've sued a mining company or if you've sued on the polymet permits, that makes you anti-mining, and you shouldn't get revenue from taconite companies. Hmm. You shouldn't get mining revenue, which is where the IRRRB gets its funds.
It is still... go ahead.
Well, of course, the actual purpose of the IRRRB is to support and help communities deal with the inevitable changes of a resource-based economy, not to use the funds as a political weapon to force communities to support the companies. And, of course, I think that goes double for the bands who have the obligation to protect treaty resources.
Oh, absolutely. And still, it's the fact that it's having access to clean drinking water. I mean, that's such a fundamental right that, well, everyone deserves to have. If you don't have clean drinking water, there's not a whole lot you can do, regardless, even if they were anti-mining and still getting, well, money, tax revenue, as you're talking about, well, from the mining companies, it doesn't even matter. They should still have access to getting clean drinking water. It's just, wow, that's kind of unreal.
That is right, and the irony has not been lost on us either, or any number of people who have submitted editorials and papers around the Northland. You know, we hope sooner than later we can make some progress on that kind of thinking in northern Minnesota.
Well, at least sounds like we do have some good news, since the commissioner, Mark Phillips, did at least approve that $250,000 grant where that money is going to be put towards that water tower. So that at least is some good news on this process.
It was encouraging to see the reaction not only from Commissioner Phillips but also from the community. And people said this is the IRRB should not be using these funds as a political weapon. This decision was absolutely wrong. The response was swift, and I think it was a good move on Commissioner Phillips' part to basically overrule the board here.
Yeah, most certainly. Hey, we're speaking with J.T. Haynes. He is the Northern Minnesota Advocate for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and expert on what's been happening with the environment in northeastern Minnesota. J.T., one more thing I want you to chime in on, and that, of course, is the big lawsuit we're seeing filed by Attorney General Keith Ellison against businesses that are part of, well, essentially big oil. What are your thoughts on this lawsuit going through? Because as I've been alluding to on some previous shows, there's a lot of parallels to the tobacco lawsuit we had back in the 1990s, where if the ruling goes in favor of the state of Minnesota and Attorney General Ellison, this could have a massive impact on how big oil operates in Minnesota.
Yeah, so this news came down yesterday from Attorney General Keith Ellison, and MCEA is definitely very supportive of the suit. We definitely think it's about time that big oil corporations are held accountable for having, you know, deceived Minnesotans for decades at great harm to the public. So this is a very notable suit. It's notable nationwide, not just in Minnesota. One thing that's interesting about Minnesota is we have particularly strong consumer protection laws, and that is the nature of this suit by the Attorney General. You know, there have been other suits elsewhere, like in Minnesota, there is an investor-based suit brought against big oil. There's a case proceeding in Massachusetts right now, and actually one was just announced, I think, today in the District of Columbia. But what's hopeful about the case in Minnesota is the consumer protection angle to it. And what that means is, you know, essentially, not only have we been deceived as Minnesotans, but we're already experiencing the impacts of this deception on our pocketbooks. Whether it's increased homeowners insurance costs, negative impacts for farmers, impacts on health, especially for low-income communities and communities of color, even changing mortgage lending practices due to the length of a 30-year mortgage. I think the Attorney General is appropriately asking, why are we paying for this? Why aren't Exxon and the Koch brothers paying for this? So, as you mentioned, that is what happened with the tobacco lawsuits, at least to a pretty large financial degree, and you know, we think that is an appropriate result here as well.
Yeah, one of the important things to bring up is that this was filed in the Minnesota court system instead of the federal system, which is significant since, as you were talking about, we have some pretty strong consumer protections here in the state of Minnesota. So hopefully in the long run that does bode well as this lawsuit makes its way through the court system, which I'm guessing is going to be a lengthy process, but the end result could be some good news for Minnesotans and those who are for protecting the environment and trying to stem the effects of climate change.
Yeah, I think so. I think the Attorney General is probably geared up for a long fight, and I imagine his office is well prepared for it.
Absolutely. Hey, we've been speaking with J.T. Haynes. Again, he's the Northern Minnesota Advocate for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, joining us now on the show talking about some environmental news in northern Minnesota and, well, the entire state as well. J.T., really appreciate the time today.
Thanks, Brett. Nice being on with you.
Yeah, definitely. We'll take a break, come on back with our final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Now, more than ever, we are being faced daily with the topic of human mortality. And for many people, estate planning has been top of mind. Getting your estate planning done now can be easy and cost-effective. Shroman Law offers virtual options for initial consultations so that new clients can safely initiate the process. With many facing uncertain financial situations, Shroman Law also offers affordable fees for legal documents. Learn more at ShromanLaw.com. That's ShromenLaw.com.
If your appliances have been limping along, or maybe you just wish they were so you could finally get that upgrade, now is the time to buy with Warner Stellion. Factory shutdowns are causing shortages in some categories, but Minnesota's own Warner Stellion has thousands of appliances in stock, including special buys no one else has, plus save an exclusive 5% with your Warner's card. You'll still enjoy free delivery and haul away by our trusted specialists. There won't be a better time, so don't wait. Save in-store or online at WarnerStellion.com.
This is New Beginnings, hosted by award-winning broadcaster and speaker Freddie Bell.
Freddie, this generation of the baby boomers, people are living longer, so the baby boomers are taking care of elderly parents.
Let's talk about your health, and specifically, let's talk about Medicare. Our show features the concerns of America's 78 million baby boomers in employment, finance, health and nutrition, and even entertainment.
Join us for New Beginnings, Saturday mornings at 11, brought to you in part by Vision Loss Resources.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. I'm a better neighbor because my service has taught me how important it is to be a team player. My training helps me in my classes when I give attention to detail to the task at hand. My service also allows me to be there for my community in ways others can't.
I help my hometown recover after nature strikes. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country and those I care about safe from threats. I also work with a network of professionals that help me succeed. Also, the Army National Guard's education benefits make getting a higher education a reality. Being an Army National Guard soldier makes living and serving in my community more rewarding every day. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Hi, this is Laura with Food Freedom Radio. In a time of growing food insecurity around the world, in the U.S., farmers are dumping milk, plowing under lettuces, and in Minnesota, a contract farmer had 61,000 birds killed against his wishes. The root structures of our industrial food system are becoming visible. Now it's time to pull up these roots, shopping farmers markets, co-op, buying directly, and growing your own food. And that's what we talk about every week on Food Freedom Radio, Saturdays at 8 a.m. or anytime on podcast.
Hi, Gregory Rich, owner of Habitation Furnishing and Design and host of Drink in the Style. Look, we're all working from home right now, and chances are you've become aware of the importance of a decent office chair. Well, I'd like to offer you a means of helping a local business while making working from home a lot more pleasant. How about considering the X chair? We can ship the X chair directly to your home. Now, I wish I could have you into Habitation to try it out, but that's not an option. So I'm encouraging you to visit xchair.com to have a look. But once you do, please give Habitation a call to place your order. Doing so ensures that you're supporting a local business at a time that we really need your help. And I'll tell you what, when you place your order by phone with Habitation, we'll discount the chairs an extra 10% off the lowest price on the X Chair website. So do your back, neck, and butt a favor and take a look at X Chair at xchair.com. Then call Habitation at 952-426-3548. That's 952-426-3548.
Next time on Philosophy Talk, the life and thought of Jean-Paul Sartre.
Sartre was famous for saying that humans are condemned to be free.
Well, that's odd. We normally consider a condemned person as someone lacking in freedom.
But having to make choices all the time, well, that's a burden.
So you're telling me there's no exit, after all.
The life and thought of Jean-Paul Sartre. Next time on Philosophy Talk.
Philosophy Talk, every Sunday at 8 a.m. and again at 2 p.m. on AM 950.
On the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Yeah, I was not following along this case of what was happening in northern Minnesota that JT was talking about where, yeah, the Fond du Lac band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, they just wanted funds for a new water tower since essentially the water that was being provided to several towns in that area was pretty toxic. But for whatever reason, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Commission basically determined that you guys aren't pro-mining enough, therefore you shouldn't get revenue from us to build your new water tower. Just an absurd argument that you don't deserve clean water because you're not pro-mining enough. Thankfully, the commissioner of the IRRB ended up ruling for the Fond du Lac band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, so they will be able to get their new water tower built. But, yeah, that is absolutely unbelievable. So thanks to JT from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy pointing that out. A couple other quick-hitter news stories to get to before we wrap up the show today. So Gregory Rich and I were talking about this yesterday, the filibuster. What do we do about the filibuster? Do we get rid of it? Do we keep it? Well, one of the high-profile Democrats in the Senate who originally was very much in favor of keeping the filibuster has changed his position. This just being reported today out of CNN, Senator Chris Coons, I think he's from Connecticut, at least somewhere in the Northeast. Yeah, he was a big-time defender of it, but now he's sort of changing his tune since it looks like one of his buddies, Joe Biden, might get in the White House. He is quoted as saying, "I will not stand idly by for 4 years and watch the Biden administration's initiatives blocked at every turn." And that's very accurate because, as Mitch McConnell said a few months ago, he will be the grim reaper for the Democrats should we have a Democratic administration. So, yeah, it does pose kind of that dilemma for Democrats. If you get that trifecta where you get control of Congress and you get the White House, do you call Mitch McConnell's bluff and get rid of the filibuster and get your legislation through? Or do you take that longer-term approach and say, well, if we get rid of the filibuster, we know exactly what's going to happen should Republicans get in power again? So at least one of the high-ranking Democrats in the Senate starting to change his tune on that a little bit. Also, this coming out of the IRS, $1.1 million, actually, I'm a little low on that, $1.5 billion was distributed to a little over a million people who are dead. Yeah, that's from the stimulus payment that we were all supposed to get. A bunch of dead people received stimulus money. Isn't that fun? And I still know some people who haven't even received their $1,200 stimulus check yet. The larger issue to point out with this, though, is that even though, yeah, this is the IRS's error, is that the IRS has been underfunded for a number of years. Now, of course, you might be sitting there thinking, well, why do we need to fund the IRS? Well, there's a couple of good reasons, because the IRS has been cut so much recently, they're not even auditing people who are from higher incomes. They're pretty much only auditing people who are from lower incomes, because they largely look at it as kind of a cost-benefit thing, where they say, well, if we are going to spend a bunch of resources auditing someone, we don't have enough resources to go against a big, high-rolling tax cheat. Instead, we're just going to go after the little guy who only makes $50,000 or $60,000 a year. So, yeah, that's what happens when the IRS gets their funding cut. Yeah, they end up issuing a little over $1.5 billion to over 1 million dead people. Kind of wish I was a dead person. I would have taken a little chunk of that $1.4 billion, or at least pretended I was dead. What else do we have in the news today? Absentee ballots. So we're still awaiting results as to what's happening in Kentucky, because the establishment Democrat Amy McGrath is running against the insurgent challenger, who has the backing of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Charles Booker. Right now, McGrath has an 8 percentage point lead, but probably doesn't mean a whole lot when we look at this statistic, because absentee ballots make up 85% of the electorate in Kentucky. That's at least what their Secretary of State is estimating. So essentially, even though McGrath is leading by 8 percentage points, only a very small portion of the vote is actually in. Now just imagine how that's going to play out on election night in November. If all of a sudden we have Donald Trump declaring that he's the winner of the election, when you have a bunch of states that only have like 10 to 15% of their vote in, since the vast majority of folks are actually voting by mail. Yeah, that's going to be a fun election night, at least on a personal level for me. I always have fun covering election night here on AM 950. And it sounds like with these absentee ballots coming in so slowly, I'm probably not going to have a whole lot to report on election night itself coming up here in November of 2020. Well, that's about all the time I got left for my show today. Stay tuned. We got Gregory Rich filling in for Matt McNeil as we are going to solve more of the world's political problems all within a one-hour time period. Yes, we are very capable of doing that. All right, stay tuned. Greg's coming up next.